This is the continuation of podcast 143 with Paul Wheaton.
Let's talk about the Spider for just a second, and that is that, okay, you've got your 64 horsepower engine, and that's a gasoline engine.
Right.
And then you outperform that with a 20 horsepower electric engine.
Motor, yeah.
With an electric motor.
Right.
And then let's say that you replaced two wheels with electric, like the motor in wheel motors. Would it go down even more?
Well, I've got a chart in this presentation that talks about the efficiency of wheel motors. You know, because they don't have drive shafts and transmissions and all that, they're like 90% efficient. Or you compare that with a gas engine that's more like 20 to 25% efficient, depending on how much it idles. If you're idling like in LA traffic, you can get down to like 10 or 15% efficient use of the, you know, the fuel that you're putting into it. But with a electric motor, a wheel motor, that if there's none of those losses. Is the heat losses are about 5%. The heat losses with a gas engine are 65%. 65% of the gas, the energy that goes into it, a gas engine, is just wasted as heat immediately. That's why you have a radiator to dissipate all that heat. Otherwise, the thing would melt. So that's 65% loss right off the top. Another 10% loss in the transmission. Another 8% loss in the suspension and the drivetrain. So that's going out to the wheels, the drive shafts, and all that. So you're getting down, you know, below 30 already, and then if you idle in traffic, it goes way down below that. The other thing about wheel motors and all electric motors is you can do something called regen. And that's when you're slowing down or braking or going down a hill, you can add energy back into the batteries. You turn the motor into a generator. AC motors automatically turn into a generator when you slow down. And they automatically, it's like putting a little spigot into your gas tank, and every time you put on the brakes, gas flows back into your gas tank. The same thing happens with an electric motor. When you put on the brakes, you turn your motor into a generator, and you generate electricity that's put back into your batteries. So with regen, not only is the motor 90% efficient or more, 95% efficient, but you're also able to add about 15 to 20% of the energy that you took to accelerate back into the batteries when you decelerate or brake. So it's more than 100% efficient, more efficient than a gas engine. Which doesn't seem possible, but gas engines can't do that.
So back to the Spider. So just thinking about horsepower-ish stuff. So you went from a 64 horsepower engine to a 20 horsepower motor, but that continued to use the same transmission and drivetrain, right?
Right.
And so then if you went to two in-wheel motors, then would you come down to be to get the same kind of the same kind of oomph? Would it, I imagine it would be an even smaller horsepower kind of thing going on.
Well, you'd probably get it down to maybe 8 horsepower in each wheel to accomplish the same thing as that 20 horsepower single motor did. Would be incremental savings, but the problem with wheel motors is that they're special built and they're like to get the ones that I wanted would have been $20,000 a piece. And I could buy a motor, a 20 horsepower motor off the shelf for $500. So there was no question that I was going to, you know, sacrifice that little bit of efficiency gain for making something that was actually practical.
So now, number seven had N-wheel motors, right?
Well, I got those off an old forklift. Those were old forklift motors, and they were only 2 horsepower apiece. So that meant it was a 4 horsepower, and it was underpowered. If I would have been able to find, like, 10-horsepower motors, or even, like, 5 or 6-horsepower motors, that would have been an incredible tractor. But at 1.5 or 2 horsepower per wheel, it was underpowered. And I had 50-to-1 reduction gears in it. Those were very efficient kind of reduction gears. Jeez, my brain is leaving me now.
So currently, to get an N-wheel motor, which would make it far more efficient. I mean, so like, let's say that the N-wheel motors were cheap. Then you could make a tractor that could run far more efficiently than the tractors where they don't have the N-wheel motors.
Well, I'm talking about at least a 20% gain, yeah.
Okay. So okay, 20% gain. So it's not like quadrupling the efficiency or anything like that. It's 20% gain.
Yeah, it's not
But it would be less parts. It'd be a lot less components. It would be a lot easier to make the vehicle.
Well, that's questionable too. There was a lot of work to figure out how to get wheel motors. And the bigger the wheel motors, the more weight you've got in the hub. So they don't really work for cars. They work fine for tractors because that's not, you know, it's unsprung weight that did on a tractor, where it's sprung weight on a car out there on the wheel. You know, it has to go up and down when you're going over the road, and that kind of weight is really hard on everything.
Okay. All right. I understand.
Yeah.
I understand. All right.
So on a tractor, they'd make a lot of sense. But like I said, they'd have to be really mass-produced. I'm talking about hundreds of thousands. And that should happen eventually, but it's not going to happen. We have to go sort of in steps, and the steps are that we do conversions of existing tractors or use existing transmissions. The other thing we haven't mentioned is you don't need a clutch in an electric vehicle because the electric motor has no momentum. It doesn't need to keep going. It doesn't need to idle while you shift gears. It stops. You know, when you stop, it stops, and you can just shift. So you don't need a clutch, and all that bell housing and all that energy in the bell housing and the you know, the clutch plates and all that energy that has to be dissipated every time you shift is just totally eliminated.
And which is yet another reason. I mean, first of all, by looking at the pictures here, I mean, it's pretty obvious that it's a very lean, clean, simple machine. And on top of that, when I compare what all I had going on with my tractor, including I had some older tractors before. I had, you know, a Ford 8N, and I had an International Harvester, and then plus all my history of driving tractors before. The key is that my electric golf cart, it's like there was just hardly anything at all to it. And yet that was my preferred vehicle to drive on the farm. And when I look at the images, the pictures that you have, then it's a similar kind of thing. There's just like hardly anything to this.
Yeah, there is.
It's very simple.
Yeah, there's a battery, a motor, and a controller, and that's it.
Well, there's, you know, some steering. And the three-point hitch.
Yeah.
In fact, you got 2 3-point hitches. You got one that faces the front and one that faces the back.
Yeah, I'm talking about your golf cart.
Oh, the golf cart.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. All right.
Battery, controller, motor, and everything. You know, the steering was the same as it was on a gas, so that didn't change. But
I remember that movie, Who Killed the Electric Car? I remember one of the things they kept talking about, like from the mechanic's perspective, was the mechanic's like, there's just really nothing here for a mechanic to do. You know, it's, and then when you work on it, you end up clean, as opposed to like when you work on a gasoline vehicle, you always end up grimy.
Yeah, well, you know, I told you that we have a RAV4 EV.
Right.
We were one of the few that got, there's only 200 of them that they sold in 2002. They were made by Toyota as an electric car, and they have a 28 kilowatt hour battery pack, nickel metal hydride, the invention of Stan Oshinsky, the guy I worked for 8 years. And that car has, we've had it since 2002 when we bought it new, and it has 120,000 miles on it. The only time I've ever lifted the hood was to change the windshield washer fluid and to show people how simple it was. It's so, never had any problems, 120,000 miles, and it still goes its rated range. Are you getting a little static?
I hear a little static, but,
okay.
You know, this is Skype to landline. I mean, I kind of can't help but think that, you know, and plus you live a little bit rurally, so, I mean, I kind of figure static is just part of the package.
Yeah, okay.
I'm still kind of amazed that you and I can have a conversation and we're like 1,000 miles away from each other. I mean, even though it's been a technology that's been available for 100 years, I'm still kind of like, this is so cool.
Yeah, it is.
So I want to get back to the big, long list of awesome things about the tractor. And so and it's like I keep hitting the little tidbits where I have a little bit of error in what I'm saying, and you, of course, you're so intimately tied to this, you need to make it clear what the full and complete truth is. So the next thing I'm thinking of is like, okay, with an electric tractor, I mean, just in fuel savings, you know, the key is like, if I'm spending $20 a week, if I spend $20 a week on diesel fuel for my diesel-powered tractor, which is slight, I would imagine, like, I work for a lot of farms where we ran a mid-sized tractor would easily see 40, if not 80 hours a week of use. Because we had shifts of guys and stuff like that doing stuff on these big farms. Let's say there's $50 a week of fuel usage, of diesel fuel. I'm just going to guess that, you know, for the average person with a farm, that might go from $50 a week, and you're just plugging the tractor in, you're charging the batteries from, you know, plugging things in. That might go from $50 a week down to, I'm just guessing, $1.50 a week.
Well, something like that, but it'd probably be more like a factor of 10 than what you suggest. But the other thing is, depends on if you're charging it off the sun. You know, I'm kind of a purist there. I'd rather not charge off the grid if the grid is dirty. In California, we have a really clean grid because we get a lot from hydro and a lot from geothermal. In fact, our county gets most of its electricity from geothermal, so I don't feel so bad about plugging in to that. But I also have about 10 kilowatts of photovoltaics that powers, you know, three homes and electric cars and electric tractors. So that photovoltaic array is, I put it in over the years, but most of it went in about 95, and it has pretty much paid for itself several times by now. And so really, you know, if you go that route, after a while, it's free. You know, it's free. It's just solar energy. It's just a day's worth of solar energy is what it costs you. And it's not costing you anything else. It's already paid for itself. So I
think it's worth exploring the photovoltaic stuff here in a little bit.
Okay.
But it sounds like what you're saying is that if I spend $50 per week on fuel for my diesel tractor, and then I switch to an all-electric tractor, then I'm going to typically see a reduction by a factor of 10 in cost.
Yeah, you'll be if you charge it at night at 7 cents a kilowatt hour, it will definitely be under $5 a week.
Okay. And then there's the potential for even greater savings by going down the photovoltaic road or micro hydro or all kinds of other things.
Renewable.
And then it might even be possible, based upon some of the other optimizations that we've already talked about and a variety that we haven't talked about, that you might be able to get it from $5 a week down to maybe even $2 a week. But that's, you know, other stuff. Okay, so then for the list of the amazing advantages to me, I mean, we've already talked about how quiet it is. It doesn't stink when you run it, and then there's the thing about the power. Now, granted, you talked about how this was an underpowered tractor, the one that's here. I'm guessing that because I'm looking at the pictures that I see here, those look like some pretty good sized bush hogs. So while it was underpowered in the drive department, it was probably fully adequately powered in the PTO department.
Well, it wasn't underpowered for most implements. We even put a baler on it at one point. It had to power the baler, but I think that it was a little taxing on the motor, and eventually it would have heated up too much. But it would run it, because electric motors will, like a starter motor. You know, let me go do a little side shoot to explain this better. When the first gas cars, you know, you had to hand crank,
right,
to get them started. Well, the thing that made gas cars, you know, acceptable to more people than people who wanted to get out in front in the snow and hand crank them was the electric starter motor. And the first electric starter motors were these monstrous things, because they thought they had to have enough power, continuous rating on the motor to start these engines. They weren't easy to start. It took quite a bit of power to turn those things over. So they had huge motors mounted on these things to turn them over. And then somebody realized that electric motors had this ability to have very high torque for short bursts of time, you know, tremendous, like 10 times their rated continuous output they could produce for like 10 seconds. And so they made very small starter motors, like the ones we have in our cars today, to start these things. And as long as you didn't crank them for a long time, they were fine. And so that's what allowed gas cars to happen. You know, initially, electric cars outnumbered, I think it was until 1904 or something like that, there was more electric cars than there was gas cars. Most people don't know that. And there was also quite a few steam cars.
What happened to the electric cars?
Well, the as soon as the electric starter motor came in, I think that was 1906, or maybe 1904, immediately gas cars became, because of their range, their ability to go long distance, and ability to refuel quickly rather than, you know, the long time it took to charge the batteries, gas cars were more popular. And within a few years, gas cars outnumbered electrics. And it was only the aristocratic people who kept their electric because they thought that the gas cars were too dirty and they didn't want to be seen in those noisy, obnoxious machines. They wanted to be in their quiet, silent, electric, clean machine. And so the people that could afford electric cars stuck with the electric cars, and they didn't have to go long distance right up until 1920 or so. Their electric cars were still popular with rich city people. But the gas cars were the, you know, the Model T came in, and there was just hundreds of thousands of those sold immediately.
Now, range is still an issue with electric cars today, and you and I have talked about this a little bit before the podcast, but when it comes to a tractor, range is really not an issue, because you'll charge it, you'll pretty much use it either half a day or all day, and then you park it and it charges, but then that's not all. Your tractor, and I know it's the number 7 because I read it on that webpage only 100 times, you have a special thing that you've done where your tractor will drive up to a pack of batteries, and the tractor will pick it up and load the pack of batteries into the tractor, and then drive off with the pack of batteries, which then charge it for a while. And if you ever forgot to charge your tractor or whatever, you could always have a second pack of batteries where you drive up to where it gets charged and drop off that pack, and then go and pick up the other pack, and then you've got a fresh set of batteries you could race off with.
Well, range is an issue in a tractor only if you're doing really heavy-duty work. Like I said, for planting and harvesting and light-duty cultivation and stuff like that, you can almost operate off a solar array. Or you can operate off a solar array for going very slow doing planting and harvesting. For cultivating, you'll need the battery pack. But for things like rototilling and stuff, range is an issue because you're using 200 to 400 amps when you're rototilling, and there's only in most of my tractors I have from 2 to 400 amp hours stored on board, which means that you can only do an hour or two of rototilling with one battery pack. So
now, I remember there's like, isn't there two different sizes of battery packs?
Well, I usually have a smaller onboard battery pack. I don't know if you ever drove a Volkswagen, old bug with a auxiliary tank.
Not one with an auxiliary tank, no.
Well, they used to, the ones pre-60s VW Bugs had a switch underneath the driver's seat. So you flip the switch when you ran out of gas in your main tank, and there was an auxiliary tank. Actually, what it did was it opened up a hole in the main tank lower than the other hole. So you're able to use, then you knew when you ran out of gas, you know, if you're not looking at your gas gauge and you ran out of gas, you knew that you could just flip the switch and you could go another 30 miles. So you could easily make it to a gas station. Well, I've got exchangeable packs that are like 20 kilowatt hours or more. And then on board, I have a smaller battery pack or the same size battery pack, depending on what I have space for. And that's like my auxiliary tank, the onboard pack. So I can always get back to the barn, you know, with the tractor. And I've actually got a patent. It's unbelievable still to me that I was able to get a patent on battery exchange in electric tractors. You know, you think of all the things that could have been done. My patent is an electric tractor patent. And it says in the claims it's on battery exchange, but in the heading it's the electric tractor. So to think that in this day and age there's still things you can get patents on is pretty amazing to me. But the battery exchange is what makes the tractor more than a golf cart. Because without battery exchange, you would be very limited to do these high-intensity operations like mowing and rototilling. Rototilling's the hardest thing. I mean, you're running these things through the ground, churning up the ground. It's a really heavy, energy-intensive use for anything. A walk-behind rototiller, you know, there's like 12 horsepower for this little thing that does a foot and a half wide rotor tiller. So that's a lot of horsepower just to churn up the ground a foot and a half wide. Well, on the tractors I build, it's a four foot wide rotor tiller. So you need quite a bit more energy pumped into that. And there's rotor tillers that are 20 feet wide on those 500 horsepower tractors that are never going to run off electricity alone. There is a size limitation to how many batteries you can store to power these things for some of the energy-intensive operations. And I think that somewhere between 20 and 40 horse is the optimum for, you know, how much weight you're putting on in batteries, for lead-acid batteries anyway. When we get into lithium, which I've done one lithium tractor with an AC drive that you can run all day rototilling, or at least half day rototilling, all day doing any other operation off the lithium pack, because it's one third the weight and about four times the energy density for it's about one third the size battery for the same performance, about one quarter the weight battery. So there you could probably, you know, do maybe 100 horsepower tractor with lithium batteries.
Oh, okay. But now with the design that I'm looking at right here with the number 7,
mm-hmm.
It seems like, you know, with fiddling and engineering, you could get it to hold more lead-acid batteries, thus it would have more weight and thus more traction,
right.
And you'd be able to go a longer time if you wanted to. But then the thing is that, you know, if you've got a couple of battery packs, then, you know, it's just a matter of swapping out battery packs. And then you can keep going. So you can go out and you can rototill for several hours. Maybe with one battery, because it seems like you had one battery pack that was twice the size of the other battery packs or something like that.
Yeah, that's the way it is on this one.
And so then you've got your bigger battery pack, and then you'll run for maybe 3 hours on the big battery pack, and then you got to pop into the barn and get the other battery pack, and then go back out and do another 3 hours or something while that battery pack is charging.
Yeah, well, I've also designed this solar charging trailer that you know, if your field's a long ways away from your barn and you've got to go out to the field, you don't want to have to drive back to the barn every time to get a new pack. You haul the solar charging trailer, and it's got a battery exchange system that you drive through there. And so you load on a fresh pack in the morning that's been charged the day before, and you go out and you do your work for the half day, and then you come back in, and you know, before you go into lunch, you pull in, drop the used pack, then pull forward a little more and load the pack that's been charged by the sun, and drive out and hook the used pack up and go off and have lunch. And when you come back, you're ready to go for another 4 hours, and you don't have to drive back to the barn because you just tow your trailer back at night. So it saves And this would be good for operations that have, you know, a field, many fields in different areas, and they have a central location, and they just take these solar charging trailers out, and you're totally independent of, you know, wherever you can take this anywhere in the world. You don't have to be hooked to a pipeline, you know.
You don't need any kind of diesel or any other kind of fuel because the sun's beating down all the time.
That's exactly right.
And along those lines, because you know, of course, this just opens up like eight other things that I want to talk about. But one of them that pops into my head is that both the tractor and the charging shed could both have outlets on them.
Oh yeah.
So one of the things that I liked to do. Is that when I went out and I because I had two different chainsaws, and I had one chainsaw that I loved and one chainsaw that I hated, and so the chainsaw I hated was you know, a steel, extra expensive, extra fancy, supposedly the very best chainsaw money can buy, and I hated that saw. Because my other saw was a cheap and cheesy saw that was an electric saw.
Yeah.
It was, and this electric chainsaw had more power. It cut through wood faster. It had a thinner kerf. It was just, it was like, and it was quiet. It's like I could go and saw wood, and it hardly made any sound at all.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking to myself, one of these days, I'm going to buy me a generator and a big, long extension cord, so when I need to go drop some trees, I'll just take this with me. I'll use the electric chainsaw.
Well, I've actually done that. All my chainsaws are electric.
So you could drive the tractor out, and like, here, I park the tractor next to this area where I'm going to be dropping some trees today.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just hook an extension cord up to the tractor, up to my chainsaw, and go out and drop these trees.
That's right.
Oh, that is so awesome.
If you look at the slide before the one that we've been talking about, number 7, if you look at number 5 there, or maybe it's number 4, I've got a skill saw. And I'm sawing a board.
Oh, yeah, I see it.
Yeah. That tractor has an inverter on board that changes the DC current in the batteries into AC house current, you know, 110 current. And so any place you take that tractor, anywhere in the world, you got AC current. And I think it's a 3,000-watt inverter, so it could power a whole house.
So another thing... Yeah, put power a whole house. That's exactly where I was going to go, is to say, screw the whole generator thing. You know, if the power goes out on the grid or whatever, then, you know, you've got your backup power right here, solar shed.
You just pull the tractor up to your house and plug in. So, you know, the other obvious uses for the tractor are for in, like, developing countries where they haven't yet got the stupid infrastructure for fossil fuels. They don't have any of that infrastructure, so they don't have anybody brainwashing them to, you know, every night on the TV to buy a bigger car and you know, get this next gadget that all depends on fossil fuel. They might think that they could just go directly to solar instead of taking that step of fossil fuel to get to solar. They just go directly to solar. They can have an electric tractor that they have the battery, exchangeable battery packs charging, and then it, like for a clinic or a school, they could pull this tractor up to the school and run the school, you know, power everything. Or if they want to show a movie in the community or they want to have computers, they just pull the tractor up and plug the whole network into it, you know. And so it could be used for schools, for hospitals, for you know, a farmer's house, you know, anywhere in the world. This tractor can power not only the operation on the field, but it can also power their home and their milking machines or whatever else they want to power. All AC, all you need is an inverter.
So another thing has to do with, because we were kind of talking about range earlier, And I guess I want to tie a bow on that and put that aside, and that is that the range issues that tie to an electric car pretty much don't exist here. I mean, there's a collection of solutions, but the dominant thing is that that limitation, that concern, does not exist for the electric tractor. Because if nothing else, for most farms that this is going to be for are going to be, you know, 5 to 200 acres kind of farms. But then if they're going to have the really big farms of 10,000 acres, they might have, you know, 5 or 10 of these tractors, and then they could just go out with the shed, and they could have the power shed with them no matter how far away they are. So they're right next to their recharger wherever they are, even if they're nowhere near the grid.
Right. Well, let's go back up to the two slides before that, and I'll talk about all the things that make tractors a much better electric vehicle than cars. You look at that slide of the cement block on the back of that, I think it's an 8N or something.
It looks like an 8N, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that cement block, this picture, I took it at the county fair, and they had a forklift on the front of this 8N, and they put this cement block on the back to balance the weight of the forklift, you know, when they were loading something with the forklift, so that the,
the back wheels don't come up off the ground.
Exactly.
When they pick something up.
Yeah, so they can have some traction. Otherwise, the back wheels lift up and they can't do anything once they lift something up. So, weight, you know, in a tractor is an asset. And that's the big difference between tractors and cars. Weight in a car is the biggest problem you got. So when I started building electric cars, and then I saw this tractor with a cement block on the back, and I thought, you know, I was having so many headaches because I first started building, I did a Fiero because that looked like it was a light car, but turns out it has a total metal body underneath the fiberglass body, and the Fieros weighed almost as much as a full-size car because they were so stoutly built. They just put these fiberglass panels over the metal body that was underneath, and so that was the first car that most people started converting was the Fiero, because it looked like it was mid-engine and you could put the batteries where the engine used to go and the weight was pretty good distribution and everything. But it was way too heavy. It was pretty inefficient. And then I did a Vanagon. I did the Vanagon because I was working on the Real Good Center. I helped build the Real Good Center.
And, wow. That goes back a ways.
Yeah. That was 95, I think, when I was doing that. And the Vanagon, I got one with a pop top. And I put a solar array on the pop top. I had about 1 kilowatt of photovoltaics on the pop top, and it was 60 miles away from my home on the coast to where I was working, so I didn't want to go more than make that trip more than once a week. And so I drove the Vanagon had about a 50 mile range, so I had to actually charge once on the way, but it wasn't too bad. I didn't have to do a full charge, just a quick 80% charge. So I stopped in Boonville, a town halfway there, and had lunch. Sometimes I'd leave on Monday morning and take my time and charge on the way and then get there. And then I'd work and the rest of the week, and I'd park the Vanagon and put the pop top up so that the solar panels were facing the sun, and I'd sleep in the pop top every night on site and be ready to go the next morning. And it took 3 days of good sunshine over in the valley to recharge the batteries, because there's just not very much room on the top, on a roof of a car, not enough room even on that flat pop top to fully charge the batteries to go be able to go make the trip home. So I drive there on Monday, charge Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and drive home. And it was a solar car. The only problem was that it weighed almost 5,000 pounds. And that's why I only had a 50-mile range. I had almost 1,500 pounds of batteries in that car. They're all under the floorboards. But that was just getting me 50 miles. So 1,500 pounds of batteries to get 50-mile range. And it took 3 days of solar energy, that all the solar energy I could get off the roof to recharge those batteries. So that's that kind of a story led me to look for the lightest car possible that I could find, and I researched, and it also had to be able to carry a whole lot of weight because batteries are so heavy, and lead acid was the only thing available back then. They're really heavy. So on my research to find this light car, I found this. It's actually my favorite car. It's a Porsche Spyder, the one James Dean made famous. But original Porsche Spyder was made out of aluminum, and they cost about $300,000 a piece, or they were worth that. So they were making these replica kits, and I could get those for a fraction of that cost. They're actually buying them one at a time. They cost me $17,000 without the engine. But when I bought them three at a time, that price went down to $10,000. And if I could get them 10 at a time, it would have dropped it down even further. So I had a plan to mass produce these things and show Detroit, you know, shame them into getting into electric vehicles. If I could do this in my garage and build a car that went 0 to 60 in 8 seconds and had a 120-mile range and sell them for $30,000, why couldn't they do that with their billions of dollars in development funds? But in the process of doing all this, I was still, this car weighed 1,000 pounds, the Porsche Spyder replica kit, the chassis and body, without the gas tank and engine, weighed about 1,000 pounds. And I had, in order to give me a 100-mile range, I had to put half battery weight, which was another 1,000 pounds of batteries. So I was putting 1,200 pounds of batteries in these and getting a 120-mile range when the batteries were new, which was something that they're still not able to do, even with lithium. And I'm still trying to shame the auto industry into doing better. The Tesla is coming out with their sedan that's supposed to get 300-mile range finally. They're going to pass up what I was doing in 95. The Vanagon, I think, still holds the passenger mile record in an electric vehicle. I got the record in, I think it was in 94 at the SEER conference, the Solar Energy Expo and Rally, in, it was in Ukiah that year, and I packed 12 people into the Vanagon, and we went something like 84 miles. It was over 1,000 passenger miles.
Oh, I see how you did it. Okay. All right.
12 people, 84 miles. I was only going about 20 to 25 miles an hour for those 84 miles, so it was kind of a grueling time. It was like the old telephone, you know, fit 12 people in a telephone booth.
Right.
But the closest
clown car, but yeah.
The closest competitor was they put, I think, 6 people in some kind of a electric conversion of a Jeep or something like that, and they went like 60 miles. So they were like way, way back there. But I don't think that record has been beaten yet. I don't know.
Well, I know that they've got those special solar racers now. And I know that they'll – I don't think they even have a battery in them. But they set out at daybreak, and then they'll go all day long, and for a lot of the day they'll be exceeding 50 miles an hour, because they're doing this in Australia, in the Australian desert, and they're getting all day sun.
Yeah, but there's only one passenger, so it would be hard to beat that record.
That's true. I see your point there.
You'd have to go 1,000 miles on one charge. And that,
but they're getting charged. I don't think they have any batteries at all.
Yeah, well, this record is dependent on batteries.
Okay. All right.
Per charge.
I get you.
Yeah.
I get you.
Anyway, that's totally off point. What I was going to say was that this poor spider, I had to put 1,200 pounds of batteries in it to make it work. And then I saw this tractor at the county fair with a cement block on the back, and everything started falling in place. Not only was the weight an asset in a tractor, but also I eliminated all the liability that there are with cars. You know, car that's going, you know, 80 miles an hour with 1,200 pounds of batteries is like an accident waiting to happen. I mean, if you ever rolled that or anything, not that it would roll because the battery weight was really low, it would probably skid a long ways before it would roll, but just that weight, thinking of that weight possibly you getting between that battery weight and a wall or something, is not something I wanted to think about.
Not pretty.
Yeah.
Although, you know, if you get into an accident with another vehicle, then the fact that your mass is three times bigger than their mass kind of gets to say that you get to win.
Yeah, I always say,
it's like the whole suburban mentality. There's all these people that are like, oh, I have to buy a suburban because then if I get in an accident, I'll be less injured, more likely to survive. And they, you know, it's that kind of thinking.
There is that line in Who Killed the Electric Car, this woman, why she was driving a Hummer, because she said, when I get in an accident, I win.
Yeah, and there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, but that's not
twisted the kind and of... fucked up as that is. It's like, oh, I'm going to drive a semi-truck fully loaded wherever I go.
Yeah, right.
If I get into an accident,
yeah,
I win.
Well, you know, that's not the kind of thinking I would like to do, base anything on, because, you know, I do mainly what I've been doing is try and help humanity not be able to find comfort in the fact that I would be able to kill everybody else before myself.
Yeah, it's got problems going down that road.
Yeah.
And as long as we're talking about weight and we're talking about batteries, now I kind of, you know, granted, it's like it's so perfect. It's kind of like it's bizarre that not every tractor made is an electric tractor right now. It just makes the amount of sense it makes over and over and over again is just amazing. But now let's talk about lead acid batteries, because when we talk about an electric car, modern electric cars, and people say, oh, the Prius plug-in sucks because every so many years you've got to get a whole new battery pack, and then that's just, you know, to the landfill, and it's all those chemicals and stuff like that. And it's like, okay, setting that whole argument aside for a moment, we're using lead acid batteries in these electric tractors because we want the weight, and as an added environmental bonus, all that lead gets totally recycled, 100% recycled. I mean, there's a huge market for used batteries because they want to reuse the lead to make more batteries.
Well, yeah, the suppliers that I use take back, they actually pay me for the old batteries. Give me $2 a battery. When they come to deliver new batteries, they buy back the old batteries. So it's, you know, unless you just want to throw money away, that you can take them to almost any hardware store, used, you know, And everybody has a battery in their car already. I mean, it's then they're all lead acid. The recycling is all set up. Any auto parts store will take back. In fact, you have to pay a core charge when you buy a new battery. I think it's about $10. And you don't get that core charge repaid until you give them your old battery. So it's virtually 100% recyclable now. And so there's basically no lead getting into the environment from batteries anymore.
So very high eco value. So when we start talking about the problems in that space with the cars, that problem, once again, for the tractor, that problem doesn't exist.
Well, I would question. We have two Priuses, and one of them has 130,000 on it, and the other has 87,000. And, you know, when we first bought them, there was all this concern that the batteries were going to go bad and la, la, la. Well, they're, one of them's approaching 10 years old, and the battery's still running strong. And my daughter, we got our first generation Prius we gave to my daughter. She has 400,000 miles on it, and it's over 10 years old, and it's still running on the original battery. She's had to replace some computer stuff, but the battery's still good. So I think the nickel metal hydride batteries, they're also ultimately going to be recyclable as soon as they get up into the quantities, if they ever do. They will be recyclable, and they do last so much longer. Lead acid batteries have to be replaced every 3 to 5 years, because it's just a diminishing return of how much range you'll be getting. You'll drop about down to about 80% of their original range in 3 years, and in 5 years they'll be down around 60% of their original range, and you'll just say it's time for new batteries. But in the with the nickel metal hydride, after 10 years, I still got about the same amount of range in our RAV4 EV that we had when we bought it. That's 120,000 miles later. So,
right.
So there is some good points about the new batteries. Lithium have, you know, they're saying 3,000 cycles. Lead acid is more like 300 cycles. So that's 10 times the life out of lithium. So that's a lot less recycling that you'll have to do, you know. And in 10 years, or 15 years, when your first lithium pack wears out, I'm sure they'll have a recycling program together for those. So I'm not too down on those technologies. I just want to see them progress to where recycling is part of their thinking.
Right. Before I forget, I wanted to mention one thing earlier, and somehow I'm just now remembering it, and that is that we were talking about with these tractors putting a rotavator on it, which is like the most power-consuming thing that we can think of, which in permaculture I think is not going to be used very often.
No.
In fact, most people with a tractor don't even own a rotavator. The next power hoggish thing might be a baler. And another one down this road would be a bush hog. These are power consuming things, but it seems to me that for most of the things that you use a tractor for, you could probably go weeks without having to recharge it. Because, you know, the kinds of things you're doing with it just don't use a lot of juice.
Yeah, that's one of the disadvantages that I found with the lithium pack, is I would only have to recharge it usually when I was just doing road work. You know, I used that tractor mainly for keeping the roads in shape. And I would forget to recharge it, because with the lead acid pack, I just plugged it in every night. You know, and that was just something I automatically did. But with the lithium, I didn't have to. You know, I didn't use that much of the, I didn't discharge it enough to have to worry about it at any one time. So, you know, a week after I'd forget, and then all of a sudden I'd realize the battery was getting low, and then I'd have to take it in when I was working and plug it in. But this nightly charging thing, you know, that was something that bugged me so much. You talk about who killed the electric car. was the fact that they were telling people, you know, and this is the oil companies and the auto industry and California Manufacturers Association that spent $60 million in negative advertising in 1995 to kill the electric car. And the way they did it was made people believe that plugging in was going to be such a chore, it was going to be so dangerous, and that lead acid batteries, which was the only thing available at the time, there's going to be lead in the environment. They actually paid supposedly reputable scientific journals to do studies that used turn of the last century, like 1800s to 1900s, when they were producing lead acid batteries, and all the lead that was getting in the environment from those manufacturing operations, and making that and taking that data and combining it with the idea that everybody in the country was going to be driving an electric vehicle with lead acid batteries in it, but not only one lead acid 12 volt battery, but maybe 300 volts of battery or 400 volts of battery. And putting that data out there as though there was going to be all the children are going to get poisoned and everything, and that it was going to be such a chore to plug in, and it just, and they made these phony company, what did they call them, public interest groups, you know, like Citizens Against Electric Cars and all these really weird things, and they said that teachers were on board with this, and doctors and firemen and policemen and all didn't want electric cars to happen, and all this stuff that you can do with $60 million. You can make anybody buy anything you want and turn them against anything. I could tell some more stories about that, but the main point I wanted to make was that this plugging in stuff is like, what would you rather do when you're low on fuel? Drive to some gas station somewhere and risk spilling poison on you and breathing poison fumes? It says right on the pump, this will cause cancer. You know, if you breathe this, it will cause cancer. And it's dangerous. And they don't say anything about it exploding, but you know what happens if you... They say, don't smoke. You know? Smoke or you will die. You know?
Right. I think it's funny. They all say no smoking, but it's like, boy, every gas station, that's where the smokers are. You know?
Yeah. But they don't say what will happen if you, you know, if you have a puddle of gasoline and put a, you know, you saw, you remember Birds, that movie, Alfred Hitchcock movie?
Right.
Where
right.
The gas dripped down, the guy got hit by a bird and he dropped the gas spigot on the ground, and then he had a cigarette and he dropped that or something, and the whole gas station exploded. That's what it'd be like, you know. But they talk about how dangerous electric cars are, and then they say what a problem it is plugging in. I don't know what is the problem with plugging in. I mean, we do it hundreds of times, probably a week. We plug in things. Plug in the toaster. You plug in electric tools. You plug them in. It's not dangerous. I mean, have you ever heard of anybody getting hurt in a tool?
It was propaganda, and it was effective. Their mission was not to do what is right.
Right.
But what was to make more money for them?
Yeah.
And they succeeded.
Right. They defeated it. They killed it. And that's
yeah,
what did it.
Absolutely.
Things like that. But, you know, when I plug in my tractor, it takes literally seconds. Or when I plug in my car, it takes literally seconds. And when I do it on a regular basis at night, I drive home, you know, in the afternoon at night, my car that was made in 97, basically, has a little computer on it that has a timer, so I can set the timer, plug it in, and it will charge at night when the electricity is the cheapest, and it automatically shuts off when the batteries are topped out. So it not only is easy to plug in, but it allows me to plug in and set the timer to charge the car in the middle of the night when the rates are the cheapest. And I have time of use electric metering, so I get paid for my photovoltaic produced electricity at 33 cents a kilowatt hour when in the summertime, summer afternoons, when the peak load is happening. That's how much they charge for electricity in net metering. And I only have to pay 7 cents a kilowatt hour at night to charge all my vehicles. So the difference is like seven times. I get paid seven times the amount during the daytime. And this is because everybody turns their air conditioners on. It's not something special that they're giving to solar. It's just because they want people to use less electricity in the afternoon when people turn on their air conditioners in the summer. But that has the benefit when I'm net metered, I'm powering the grid and providing electricity to my neighbors. And during those peak times, they are paying me 33 cents a kilowatt hour. So my electricity is, you know, I have a $500 surplus most of the time on my electric bill because I'm net metered with my photovoltaic array. And I'm, you know, that's not only for powering my home, that's powering all my transportation. So you think about people using an average of 800 gallons of fuel a year in this country. That's a lot of money. What did we figure that was? That was $3,600 or something like that. If fuel was $3-$4 a gallon.
Right. Well, before we started the podcast, we were doing a lot of calculations based upon what's the average amount of fuel that people use for a car, apparently the national average is 800 to 1,000 gallons. And we were trying to and this kind of came to a different thing that we were talking about of like if a person were to go out and buy a purely electric car and then they used it for their local driving, and then that one time every 4 months it's like, okay, now they're going to go on a trip, that and then of course the electric car doesn't do very good on a long trip. But what they could do is they could get this electric car, and it has a range of maybe 100 miles or 150 miles, and they do all their, you know, local driving, and they plug it in at night. And then what you were saying was, and then we did the math, we're like cranking on the math, and you were very adamant that our math be very exact. what we discovered was is that if you took three trips per year that were like long distance trips, that and then the rest of the year you used an all-electric car, that the fuel savings alone would be $3,000 per year that you could then turn around. So you would basically have this $1,000 per trip for three trips per year to rent a gasoline vehicle.
Right.
Which I thought was a very interesting way of looking at it, I thought that was really rather amazing. I think that if you rent a car for a week, isn't it something like $300?
Well, it's probably less than that. It depends on how much you're doing fuel too. But when I was working in Michigan for that solar company, I rented a lot of cars, and it was usually like $29 for per day, something like that. So,
right. I think it probably depends on the vehicle too. It could be anywhere from $100 a week to maybe $500 a week. But the thing is, if you're just going to take a trip that's a long distance trip, go on three vacations a year or something like that, then the all electric vehicle might be the way to go, and then you just simply rent a car for the big trip. So if you take only one big trip a year or two big trips a year, you know, Thanksgiving and...
Well, have you heard of the car share concept?
I have.
Yeah, well, that's what I would rather think about. Rather than renting it, like I live on a ridge, and there's probably 30 households on this ridge. And we could have, you know, maybe two pickups and maybe two to five cars for the whole ridge. And we could, you know, schedule our trips so that we weren't all going at the same time, or we didn't all need to go get a load of manure or something at the same time. So those pickup trucks would do for the whole ridge. And then each of us would have our electric car, you know. So the cars, you know, we would jointly own the cars that we needed for long trips and specialty vehicles like pickup trucks for making runs to get something that weighed a lot, which you can actually have an electric pickup truck too. I hope they make them again someday. That Ford made the Ford Ranger electric, and it worked. It had a 50-mile range. So a lot of times when you're getting manure, you're not going 50 miles. Getting it from the barn down the road. So electric vehicle work for that too. Or you could just put a trailer on your tractor, your electric tractor, and get the manure. So scratch that. You don't need the electric, or that you don't need the pickup truck. I don't want to get a big pickup truck anyway. But you do need these cars for long distance, and you can get a plug-in hybrid now for long distance. So you have your electric for local, and you have your gas backup for long range, or you could have one dedicated gas car that the whole group of people could share, you know, a bunch of families could share, and just plan your trips around that. Or it could be big enough you could take trips together, you know.
True. Or, you know, I think that I remember there have been a couple of times where I looked into the cost of renting, and it seems like there were some places where they were so cheap. It's kind of like, wow, renting a car is cheaper than the car payment for buying a car. And you can change, you can try out a different car like every week or every month or whatever. I thought that was, you know, kind of weird. But that's, now we're getting way off topic.
Way off, yeah.
This podcast will be continued in part 3. If you like this sort of thing, come out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about electric tractors, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.